Well, tonight we're going to take a walk on the supernatural side. Dr. Melvin Moore's back on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about consciousness and near-death experiences and so many other facets of his work. And we'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, you're back with us on Coast to Coast with Dr. Melvin Moore. He's researched near-death experiences in children and adults for more than 15 years. Now, this interest evolved from experiences working in critical care medicine at Seattle's Children's Hospital. Here's Dr. Melvin Moore back on Coast to Coast. Melvin, how are you?
I'm doing so great, and I can tell you it's a pleasure to be back on your show.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward
to one of the real radio shows I look forward to, where you know you have intelligent listeners, and we've got plenty of time to really flesh out.
Well, and there is so much going on, Melvin. It truly is incredible, and I think we may have lost our connection with you. So we will get you back on in a moment or two. We'll make that call and we'll get you back on. Dr. Melvin Morris, of course, is our special guest tonight who has, there he is with us. Melvin, you there?
I'm right here.
There you go. We lost you all of a sudden. You just popped off and here you are. So I'm glad you're here. Okay. Anyways, tell me more about what you've been doing lately since we last talked.
Okay. Well, as you know, back in, the 1990s, I studied near-death experiences and was part of the research that establishes that near-death experiences are, they're real. There's no, that's the way the kids, I studied near-death experiences in children, and not only are they real, but they're realer than real. And I tried to try to understand what exactly is going on with the near-death experience, though, because after all, I don't care how you slice it or dice it, you can't get away from that. Perhaps near-death experiences are just some final hallucination of the mind. There's some final farewell. To this life that maybe we evolved to ease us into the transition of death, as if nature would ever be so kind. But nevertheless, I think that's a respectable point of view, and one that if you look just straightforwardly at near-death research, I don't think that you'll ever get past that. I think that we've sort of bumped up against the limits of what we can learn from near-death research. So I went then into remote viewing, which I consider to be a window into the near-death experience. Because after all, with remote viewing, we're seeing something through non-ordinary means, but then we can take our logic and our analysis, we can use our left brain, and we can validate the experience. And so I've been primarily interested in remote viewing for the last 4 or 5 years. And really now, just to skip to the bottom line, I see remote viewing as a subset of intuition. And I see intuition as nothing less than our brain's connection with God. If you, more scientifically minded, you might call the all knowledge, timeless, spaceless domain, or quantum non-locality. It's interesting to me, how many different names we have for what most people, and the children I studied commonly call God. But George, I hope we'll have a chance to get into the science of it, because there's no getting around it. Science has now completely merged with these understandings. The paradigm shift is here. It's been in science for probably 10 years, and it just takes a while for these things to now percolate through general science and to the public. But we are learning now that our brains are truly connected to the universe in not just as a spiritual saying, but as an actual scientifically validated fact. Here, well, I'll just give you one right now.
Okay,
from Scientific American. Just real quick, I'll tell you that we've learned now that birds remote view. That birds remote view as part of their navigation of the skies when they're flying. So if birds can remote view, obviously humans can do it.
Absolutely. Now, is it unusual for so many people to think about near-death experiences as merely being a process of the brain?
Well, you know, everything about us as human beings is a process of the brain. And so it's so hard, George, to get away from the fact that everything that we're experiencing is an illusion. It's in fact created by the mind. As you know, we have two separate streams of human consciousness. One of those is the pure sensory, memory, emotion stream of consciousness, a billion bits of information every second. And then our left brain dips into that and probably takes maybe 10 to 20,000 bits of information and creates this reality that we cling so tightly to. And so, you know, and quite frankly, very crudely, by the way, you know, people who think that we really see reality are not up to date on the science. I'll give you a quick example.
Sure.
Facial recognition. You see an old friend of yours, or you see, you know, somebody you've just met, but you know what their face looks like, and boy, you just think that you're really seeing their face. Absolutely not. You're probably only seeing at most 10 to 20 points of information off of that face, and then you're just constructing that face. You're just inventing that face. The mind can be very easily fooled into thinking one face is another. And interestingly enough, the neuroscientists now even recognize the concept of non-locality. They say that this information about the face is stored in face space. Face space. It's nowhere in the human brain is face space been shown to exist. But so we create this reality very crudely, but we hang very tightly to it. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that most people think that the near-death experience is just in the brain. I think that it's very difficult to think anything else, because we don't have any other frame of reference. That's why everybody listening to this should learn to remote view. Once you've remote viewed, it changes your boundary conditions, so to speak.
Well, are you saying that remote viewing is like the near-death experience?
Well, I mean, there's nothing like the near-death experience. I mean, the near-death experience, you're dying. You have a fairly dead or dysfunctional brain, and yet you're still the very first child I ever resuscitated. She was clinically dead easily for 19 minutes. There's no doubt in my mind that she was dead. And I do sort of have the great privilege of, most of these patients are resuscitated myself. And yet when I interviewed her 2 weeks later, she goes, "I wasn't dead at all. I was still alive." So I'm not in any way saying that remote viewing is like the near-death experience. I'm saying it's a tiny piece of it. I'm saying it's a window, it's a peek into it. But nevertheless, the imagery is very, very similar. Remote viewers have what they call the aperture, and the aperture they've drawn pictures of it. It's like a big long tunnel, and at the end of the tunnel comes a big rainbow. Well, I could show you about half a dozen children's near-death experiences in which they've drawn me the identical drawing, in which they say that's their near-death experience. So realistically, what's happening is when we die, we have, of course, the loss of input from all of our senses, and so then that's the darkness that people perceive.
Sure.
And then we dip back into that billion bits of information, that sensory stream of information, and you're right back into the rainbow of light. And the remote viewers, when I first learned to remote view, I was shocked that they throw up on their, screen there, they say this is the aperture, and it looks exactly like a child's drawing of a near-death experience. And it just reminds me very much of, a child that told me that during his near-death experience, he says that he was in the big noodle, and inside the noodle, well, maybe it was a tunnel, maybe it was a noodle, but for sure it was a rainbow. And that's what controlled remote viewers describe. They say that they're going back into the sensory stream. The first thing that happens to them, they see lots of different colors. And then they grab a hold of new information. They grab a hold of another 10,000 bits of information, and they construct some new reality.
I can't remember the moment I fall asleep. I don't know if you can, Melvin. Can you?
No.
Right before you fall asleep, it's almost like the death experience, isn't it?
That's true.
Black out. You're gone, and that's it. Now, let's look.
George, wait a minute. Wait. Well, okay. Well, let me hear where you're going with this, because
right.
I want to come back to this. Okay?
All right. So I'm saying one of two possibilities then. Assuming in the sleep experience you don't remember your dream, mm-hmm. then there's nothing until you wake up again. And you, in all this time, 6 hours, 8 hours, however long you slept, has gone by. You have no idea what's happened. It was like you were dead for that period of time. Now, on the other hand, if there is an afterlife, you probably, when you close your eyes at the moment you die, which is like when you fell asleep, you should, if there's an afterlife, pick up as if you're in that dream state. And things are functioning, and you may not know you're dead, but things are happening. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Well, you've described exactly what happens. Children and adults that have the near-death experience, they describe precisely what you've just said. They don't describe falling asleep. They describe still being awake.
So let's go back for if that's the case. And that is what could be happening. Do you think when someone dies, it takes them a while to realize that they're even dead?
Oh, absolutely. George, I've interviewed hundreds of people who had near-death experiences. I've interviewed probably nearly 100 children or adults that I've resuscitated myself. And they are deep into the experience before it hits them that they're dead. Like I told you, the first child I ever resuscitated, I wasn't dead at all. I was alive. and
that's
their,
right.
They're so preoccupied that they're still alive. I remember one young man had the out-of-body experience, and all he could think about was, how am I going to get back in my body? He hadn't even considered that he was dead. He was just like, oh my God, boy, how am I going to get back in there? What am I going to do? I can't just keep floating around here all the time.
That's right. And can I get back in there? That's what I would be worried about.
So there's a prolonged period of time. Fortunately, the experience. I can't speak for adults. I don't have that much experience interviewing adults, but with children, invariably there's some sort of a spirit guide, or sometimes it's not even a spirit guide. Sometimes it's a pet, This one young man, he said to me that it was his dog who had died years before, and he said his dog was nagging at him to go somewhere. So there is some sort of a companion or a guide that accompanies through the experience. And maybe, this is just speculation on my part, but maybe that's why we have a guide. This is precisely the point that you raise, is that it takes a while to realize that you're dead. And it helps you to get over that period of disorientation. That's obviously just speculation, but it seems reasonable.
Well, because when I'm in my dream state, and apart from it being a lucid dream, I'm not aware about paying bills or having an appointment tomorrow or anything like that. I'm just in my dream doing whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I assume that when you die, it might be like that for a long time.
Well, yeah, you know, I love your comment because so many people sort of casually say to me, well, how do we know that the near-death experience isn't just a dream? Well, you know, other than the obvious, dreams don't happen to you when your brain is dead. But, you know, other than that slight little difference. But, you know, you've raised a good point, is that during the dream state, you know, you either don't remember anything or you're in the dream itself.
Mm-hmm.
But people that have the near-death experience, by and large, have the experience of their own body. They more have a sense of dual consciousness than you see in dreams, other than, as you point out, the lucid dream. But listen, I got to back up and point something out that I think is fascinating, and I'm not sure what it means, but the transition state when we fall asleep and the transition state when we wake up is known as the hypnagogic or in the hypnopompic states. And these states are clearly another window into non-local consciousness. And many famous people took advantage of this. Robert Louis Stevenson used to have he used to sort of sit, and he had this sort of device that when he would fall asleep, it would sort of wake him up. And then he would quickly write down all of everything that he could remember, you know. So that transition state that is, you know, that you're talking about before, that is hard to remember. Interestingly enough, does seem to be another one of these transitions, like lucid dreaming, transition into non-local consciousness.
What is spiritual neuroscience? What is that?
Okay, so spiritual neuroscience to me is how we use our brains to communicate with each other, how consciousness uses the brain to interact in this reality. So it's sort of turning the conventional neuroscience on its head. You know, conventional neuroscience, of course, is that somehow consciousness evolved out of brain activity. I don't think anybody believes that anymore. So spiritual neuroscience to me is, if you can understand how the brain works, then you're going to have a much better way of understanding your own spirituality. I'll give you just, you know, a really obvious example. Our left brain, and George, please, these are very loose terms.
I understand.
For neuroscientists who are listening, I want to reassure them that I'm well aware that what we call the left brain is, you know, is a little bit more complex than that. And what we call our right brain is probably involves many aspects of the left brain as well. But I think just for, you know, for conversational purposes, roughly our left brain is very analytic and very logical and is responsible, you know, for language and for creating our sense of this, you know, this local, this personal reality that we have. It's our internal narrator, if you will. But so our right brain is that stream of consciousness that's primarily sensory and memory and such as that. And it's non-analytic. It's not judgmental. And it actually functions differently than the left brain. The right brain is not very good at putting things together. It's good at sorting and organizing thoughts, but not very good at combining and creating concepts. So, for example,
hold on, Melvin. We're going to hit the break, and we're going to come right back with you, and we'll talk about spiritual neuroscience as we get into near-death experiences and consciousness on Coast to Coast AM. With our guest, Dr. Melvin Morris. By the way, a couple of his works, Where God Lives, Transformed by the Light as well. We'll be back more as we talk about his research into remote viewing, consciousness, and near-death experiences in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Melvin Morris, of course. Melvin, let's finish up on the spiritual neuroscience. You were talking about how important it is. And then we'll get into some other aspects here.
Sure. I think everybody has a rough idea of right brain consciousness, which is timeless, spaceless. But I think we need to also understand. Hello?
Yep, I'm there.
Okay. Involves sorting and organizing, usually very symbolic, a lot of mathematical imagery. And the one aspect of it I wanted to emphasize is when I was a medical student, I was at Johns Hopkins and was the last of the great neurosurgeons who would actually remove half of a patient's brain.
Oh, my.
Usually for intractable seizures. And I remember very vividly this one young man had the left side of his brain removed. And so you would ask him, like, to draw a clock. And all he could draw was a circle and a big pile of numbers and then the hands of the clock. And yet he would look at it and he would say, that's the clock. And, you know, so he couldn't actually put things together. Okay, so what does this have to do with? If you're in a spiritual state of mind, if you're getting spiritual information, it's not going to make sense. It's not going to be logical. It's not going to be rational. It's going to come with a lot of symbolic imagery, and you're not going to be able to assemble it into anything that makes sense. Your rational or left brain has to do that. And so this is why it's so important that your left brain be aware that, you know, that information, new information can come in through your right brain, because too often your left brain will just reject it, will just say, no, that's crazy, that doesn't make any sense to me, so it'll get rid of it.
Can you function with half a brain?
You know, remember, I know, see, that's one of the big pieces of evidence that, in fact, consciousness comes first. That consciousness is sort of the ecosystem, you know, the greater system that then expresses itself through a brain. Because, in fact, they removed half of people's brains, and they functioned just fine. They walked with perhaps a little bit of a limp. They had the sort of peculiar characteristics I was telling you about, you know, that they can't, you know, assemble the pieces of a clock, but they can draw all the individual pieces. But sure. So think about it. I mean, it's going even further than that. Now there's something that we call a functional neurogenesis, which basically is that neuroscience researchers have shown that our thoughts create new brain cells, and that this is the way we heal when we have severe strokes or brain trauma.
That's amazing.
And this is how, for example, I'm working with a woman now who lost 80% of her brain in a stroke, and she was in coma for 7 years.
And now, when you say, Melvin, she lost 80% of her brain, are you talking about 80% of the function or 80% of the physical part of the brain?
80% of the physical part of her brain. And all of the cortex, you know, the outer part of the brain. And she was in a coma for 7 years.
Wow.
7 years. And yet she came back with her personality and her sense of humor. That's one of the most surprising parts to me. Her sense of humor, her personality, her memories all returned intact. So for those who are still clinging desperately to the materialist myth, where was her brain? Where was her personality? You know, all those years. You know, obviously, people just got. We got to get over it. I mean, this is an informational universe. Information is the basis of reality. It's information that exists out there, or in here, or wherever you want to say it. And information, in turn, is used by the brain. To function, you know, the laws of physics create this material reality, and we use our brain to interact with each other. And so that's why I call it spiritual neuroscience, because the more we learn how our brain uses spiritual information, I think the more spiritually connected we're going to be.
But years ago, I remember, Melvin, years ago, I remember science telling us all that once a brain cell dies, it can't regenerate. They were wrong,
yeah.
Weren't they?
You know, it's funny because, you know, I had such an amazing career. I seem to have just sort of stumbled into, you know, some of the all the greats of neuroscience. And when I was a medical student, I vividly remember Fred Gates, who is the father of this field of functional neurogenesis, you know, where thoughts can actually create brain cells. And he made that very point that that you just said. He said, this is really scary, you know, this discovery that brain cells can actually grow in response to experience. He said, what's going to happen to us, you know, to our personalities? Is our personality going to change, you know, minute by minute? you know, or, I mean, how can anybody be stable if the brain is constantly changing? And, of course, now we've gotten over all that. You know, we understand now that there's a, you know, it's no different than finding out that much of nature is based on mathematical principles. And that you can take the physical aspects of nature away, but the mathematical principles, you know, which aren't real. I mean, isn't that right? I mean, they're immaterial. They're not real. We can't touch them. They're theories, and yet the mathematical principles underlie physical reality. We can take the physical reality away. We can replace it with some other completely physical form. And sure enough, you know, let's say it's a wave, or let's say it's a, you know, whatever. Let's say it's the coastline of Maine. Let's say it's a jet turbulence. It immediately comes back based on this immaterial reality.
There was something I would also suggest that the cell, that the new replicating cell somehow picks up on the memory of the old dying cell that it's replacing, except it comes back healthier. What do you think?
Are you reading these neuroscience textbooks right there?
No, I wish.
George, this is why you are so great at what you do. This is why I love to listen to your show, because you just have such an intuitive feel for it. Not only is what you said exactly right, but they found that the new cells grow in the hippocampus. And that's a, you don't have to, and nobody has to remember that word hippocampus, but it's one of the deepest areas of the brain, and it's the area of the brain that's associated most with memory. And so there's no doubt about it that when these new cells form, they are picking up on the memories of the old cell. They're picking up on the new experiences, and then they travel from that area of the brain. They travel throughout the brain wherever they're needed, and it's not even just the brain anymore, because we know that the neuroscientists now call it the brain body. Every time you think a thought, you're showering your body with a million different, well, not a million, but, you know, thousands of different, proteins and, various hormones and chemicals, et cetera. And then it's all reinforcing right back to your brain again and creating new brain cells.
But
I just wanted to finish up real quick with give people a practical example. What am I talking about with spiritual neuroscience?
Sure.
Well, let's take, for example, we've heard of, you know, Reiki, our energy healers, et cetera. For people to function best in as energetic healers, they have to go into this right brain state. And so that's why, when you look at the ancient principles of energy healers, and people have done this, you know, for thousands of years, they talk about, for example, chanting, saying phrases over and over and over again, because by doing that, then you're getting out of your left brain state, you're getting out of your internal narrator. This is why attention is so important. People often talk about intention, but intention is a very complex, I have the intent to heal you, then that's always going to throw you into a left brain state, and you're not going to be able to actually do it. Somehow you have to get yourself into this right brain state of consciousness, and that's why, for example, Reiki uses a lot of symbols and a lot of imagery, and this is why it's best to work with a partner, and so your partner can do a lot of the left brain tasks for you. People are asking you questions, and you have to, respond. You have to think about the question, you know, like, what am I going to do next? That's going to immediately throw you into a left brain state. And so you're going to be more powerful, and you're going to be, the more you can stay in right brain, non-local consciousness, the better, for example, you're going to be as a remote viewer, the better, for example, you're going to be as a medium, the better you're going to be as an energetic healer, any of those non-local tasks. And people, you know, have to start learning to do this. When you look at the literature on what we could do with energetic healing, extraordinary. There's many, many nice, well-done studies showing that energetic healers can shrink tumors, etc. And yet you go into any hospital in this country and all the Reiki energy healers are doing is dealing with pain and stress and
that's right.
pretty dumbed down exercises for what they're capable of.
Who are these helpers in the afterlife? You know, the people that they claim to be, you know, relatives, angels. What are they doing there in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, you know, I mean, this is just my take on it, but I don't know. I've been doing this for, you know, now it's 25 years.
It's a long time.
We got to just stop thinking of it as the afterlife and just really think of this as an informational universe. That's, you know, I mean, my wife is very religious, so, you know, to put it in religious terms, you know, this is all, you know, in the mind of God, if you will. The Christian Bible says in the beginning was the Word or what have you. But if we see this as an informational universe, that we're just one gigantic pulsing pattern of energy, well then, you know, a person's life is information. A child who's died, that's information. My memory of a little lammy that I had when I was 2 years old, that's information. It's information. And when you talk to people who have near-death experiences, they say very graphically, if people are interested, by the way, I don't sell anything on my website, except I sell a few of my books that people could get better at, cheaper at Amazon.com.
But
I don't want to sound like I'm plugging my website because really, I this information I just have out there. But I probably have 100 videos of people and children describing their near-death experiences, and many of them describe very vividly as they return from non-local reality that they lose the knowledge. As one woman, she says, it was horrible. You know, as I came back into my body, everything that I knew was just going backwards, backwards, backwards. And I was back in my body. And I wondered, you know, she had a near-death experience when her baby died, she had died, during the experience. And she says, I wondered who was born here. So now to answer your question directly, sure, I think these helpers are just pieces of information that are designed to help us with the transition from this world of this school, if you will, where we learn our lessons of love, the transition back to the, you know, all information domain. And they're pieces of information that present
it's fascinating.
As helps us.
I can tell, Melvin, that you love what you do. You have a passion for this, don't you?
Well, I retired from the University of Washington to just go into this kind of research. Sure, this is the kind of research it's a neat field of research because it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The more, you know, as soon as you answer one question, you know, a dozen more pop up. Just as you're seeing, I mean, you know, well, who are these helpers? Well, why do the helpers appear the way they do? Are these helpers God presenting themselves in a way that we can understand? Or is that really going to be, you know, when I die and my wife dies before me, is that really my wife waiting there for me? I mean, those are really profound questions.
Well, they sure are. Now, when you said earlier that science is starting to catch up with all of this, what are they doing? I mean, how many real scientists are out there studying this near-death experiences?
All righty. Okay.
So gotcha.
You got me. Come on. I'm trying to put a good spin on it. Okay. Well, the most interesting ones are the ones who don't seem to care at all about spirituality or near-death experiences or even the implications of their own research. So, and there's, how many of them are there? Oh, maybe 20. But nevertheless, listen to what they're doing. Okay, so for example, I'm corresponding now with a neuroscientist in Germany, and he has shown very nicely that our eye, you know, when we see something, it's not the way that we used to think it was, where, you know, light is hitting the back of the eye, and then that light is processed and then reprocessed and packaged, and finally a visual image is created at the back of your brain. That's the way we used to think it is. Well, he's shown very nicely that when light hits the back of your eye, simultaneously, instantly, about 30% of the information is blended from, like, face space, for example, wherever the heck that is, memory, from, you know, conditioning as to what we think the world should look like, etc. And it happens so fast that it can't simply be a biological process in the brain, that it's a non-local experience. They've shown a number of these non-local experiences. We all know, you know, heard about entanglement, you know, how, you know, photons that are split from a single event still somehow stay in contact with each other, you know, even if they're apart, you know, hundreds and thousands of miles from each other. Well, that's happening right in your brain in the back of your eye. So, I mean, that's extraordinary. I mean, that would seem to say that our eyes are somehow replicating a lot of, you know, the spiritual understandings and insights. But yet, whenever I talk to him about this stuff, he just goes, oh, I'm not interested in that. He seems to have no interest in remote viewing and no interest in the implications of his research for how our brain could be connected to the universe. So I think that, you know, there's a number of scientists like that. They're just so fixated in their field. They're the guys that are doing the functional neurogenesis work. I've tried to engage them spiritually many, many times, you know, and try to say, hey, doesn't that mean something to you that we can have a thought and that can create a brain cell? And then that brain cell, as you were saying earlier, George, seems to be intermingled with memory. And then it actually knows some mysterious way how to go to where it's supposed to go in the brain. And they're just blank walls. They're just like, oh, huh. You know, so I think a lot of the science is along those lines. And then I think of scientists who are really trying to mesh and put all this together, maybe another 100 in the world. So it's not a lot. It's not a lot. But it's enough. It's enough.
Well, and it's starting, and it's growing.
Yeah, that's what I think it is. That's, you know, I think information science, you know, a lot of this comes from other sciences. You know, information science is very big in the computer world, very big in our understanding how cell phones work, very big in the natural sciences and engineering. And yet they don't, you know, again, there's a disconnect. They don't seem to understand that if you apply Turing's principles, for example, to consciousness, wow, suddenly we understand something completely new about consciousness.
Well, that's true. And we're going to talk about a couple of your conferences, Melvin, when we come back, as well as consciousness on Coast to Coast AM.